Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. As has become increasingly obvious in recent weeks, white female progressives seem to be among the primary drivers and foot soldiers of the organized, state-supported insurrection currently ravaging the failed state of Minnesota, of violent anti-ICE resistance across the country, and just of anti-Trump venom more generally. Why is this? Why do so many women seem to be more passionately engaged in literally risking life and limb to tangle with immigration law enforcement, in defense of people who are not only in this country illegally, but many of whom are felons of the most heinous crimes? This actually isn't a new phenomenon. As George Orwell wrote as far back as the late 1940s in his book 1984, quote, "It was always the women, and above all the young ones, who were the most bigoted adherents of the party," unquote. But it just seems to be intensified in our present circumstances, with women, especially but not always young white women, apparently transferring their mama bear protectiveness toward the illegal aliens they irrationally believe are such vulnerable victims. A large part of the answer stems from the massive influence of feminism in the West, a corrosive ideology that has indoctrinated women to reject their feminine nature as the nurturing heart of home and family, and to embrace instead a masculine drive for aggression, competition, and career. It has spawned a political rage that we see being unleashed online and in protests on streets and campuses. Today, my guest is an author who has brilliantly diagnosed the roots and fruits of feminism as an alternate belief system to Christianity, an ideology that has perverted women's natural instincts into something destructive and subversive, and that is at the heart of our cultural ills. She has a new book out that I've read and highly recommend that will open your eyes about a cultural mindset that has completely conquered the West over the last half century or so, and which we must throw off if we have any hope of getting our society back to sanity and stability. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take, if you don't already, so that you don't miss any of the compelling conversations we're having here. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is the founder and editor at the online women's magazine TheologyOfHome.com, and is the author of 10 books, including The Anti-Mary Exposed and The End of Woman, both of which I've read, and I also got my wife her book, The Theology of Home, which she loves. Her new book is Something Wicked, Why Feminism Can't Be Fused with Christianity. Carrie Gress, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
First, tell us what The Theology of Home is all about.
Yeah, so this is a really fun project. I had the idea for Theology of Home, the term itself, on my treadmill about 8 or 9 years ago, and it occurred to me, you know, everybody, all the women that I know, what we really want, and really Christians in general, is we just want to get everyone that we love home to heaven. And, you know, our homes are actually meant to be a foretaste of heaven. There are similar things that we can say about our homes, that we can also say about churches, that we can also say about heaven. They're places that are meant to be nourishing. They're meant to have light, comfort, safety, hospitality, all of that. So so the first book, and there are three subsequent ones in the series now, the first book really focuses on what that is. But we also had a great time filling it with really beautiful images of family life and what our homes are meant to look like. I think, you know, it's easy for all of us to think about what our, you know, a home that feels more like hell. But that's obviously not what the home is meant to be. It's meant to be really a place where we're nurtured and then launched out into the world. So that was the main idea. And it's just been such a fun project because there was never a book like it that had both rich philosophy and theology, but also some, you know, beautiful imagery that I, you know, we hear all the time. Women just kind of spend a couple of days with each page and then move on, or, you know, it's a great coffee table book for guests to pick up. So it's been a really fun project. And then, of course, we have a blog that goes with it that goes out 5 days a week for women to help help women, you know, be guided by something beautiful and compelling instead of all the garbage that we find in the culture today.
Excellent. Well, I know that my wife really loves the whole concept and the book, so.
Well, that's great.
So you're doing great work.
Thank you.
Now let me ask you about your book, The End of Woman, mm-hmm. How Smashing the Patriarchy Has Destroyed Us. Yeah. In that one, you also took feminism to task for the damaging lies it has mm-hmm. sold to women and its demonization of men. Mm-hmm. You write in it that feminism's failure is its misdiagnosis of what ails women, and that mm-hmm. rather than fix anything, it's actually erased women one slow step at a time. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great way to sort of crystallize what I was doing in that book. What I looked at initially was, and I go through the whole history of feminism. I start with Mary Wollstonecraft in that book and then get up mm-hmm. through the trans movement. And one of the things that we see with feminism is this desire to try to make women more like men and this effort to tell women, you know, your life is going to be much better if you mimic men and not even good men. Promiscuity and power plays and all of that are really kind of baked into the whole ideology. So yes, it goes through and just shows how, you know, women initially are told they don't need to be at home. Then they don't need their husbands. They don't need to have children. Women are actually, you know, told to be at war with our own bodies because of our fertility, yeah. That it's something that we obviously have to control or, you know, somehow it will control us. And then finally, the real ultimate aspect of this erasure of womanhood is the trans movement, where we're literally hacking body parts off to make yeah. women more like men. And so that I think that's the real tragedy, is it's been very gradual and very slow and presented to us as something very compelling. And yet the damage has just been catastrophic, especially if you look at abortion numbers and also even just the you know, what's going on with women themselves in terms of general happiness. We don't have a lot of data that's pointing to women being happier because of feminism. In fact, it's quite the opposite.
You mentioned Mary Wollstonecraft. I think a lot of people assume that feminism began more or less with the women's suffrage movement, mm-hmm. but Mary Wollstonecraft goes back to the late 18th century. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about her a bit about her impact on the origins and development of feminism? She declared that the world was a vast prison for women and that women were born slaves, and that's pretty much been a thread that has run throughout feminist thought pretty much up to the present, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has been. I think this is one of the things that, you know, most of us get wrong. I know when I started researching the book, The End of Woman, I thought, okay, I'll take 2 days to do the first wave of feminism.
Yeah.
Just find some nice quotes and then I'll move on. And I'm not done yet. I'm still researching the first wave and just really seeing an incredible amount of just distorted thinking and distortions about women. And Mary Wollstonecraft was really the first one to be very focused on this idea of godless egalitarianism. She wouldn't have called it godless because she was actually a Unitarian. She started out as an Anglican, then moved towards becoming a dissenter, and then ultimately became a Unitarian. So she didn't actually believe in the divinity of Christ. She was also very focused on this idea of rationality, that, you know, through our use of reason, we can get to God. So any male mediator, be it a pastor, a priest, or even Christ himself, was an obstacle to women's potential, is what she believed. And you can see that in her language too, you know, like that quote you just read, but also this the idea that she really perpetuated, which is that women would be better off if they were like men. If we just educated women a little bit more the way men were, then we could sort of become interchangeable. And so that's one of those early ideas that comes from her. And then especially the Unitarianism. I don't think many of us realize, I know I didn't realize, that all of the women in the women's movement, it was different than the suffrage movement per se. They eventually kind of overlapped. But for the most part, there was this whole women's movement that was going on that was deeply embedded in this idea of Unitarianism. Or the occult or atheism. All of those pieces were really at play. So it wasn't this sort of nice Christian ladies movement that they were just trying to get, you know, the vote for women. There were a lot of other things swirling around, particularly things like getting rid of marriage. And also, as you mentioned, this idea of women being treated as slaves. Elizabeth Cady Stanton was very specific in her belief that she thought that Christianity was used by men as a tool to enslave women. So, yeah, when you start looking into this, and gratefully, most of it's in English and accessible online. You know, I didn't have to go to some dark libraries to find all this content, yeah. Although I did have spent some time there as well. But yeah, this is that you really realize the whole narrative has been just very sugar-coated, and that's not, this is not the reality of what was actually happening at the time.
And then when Karl Marx came along, mm-hmm. His influence really sort of supercharged feminist thought, didn't it? Because Karl Marx was all about the abolition of the family.
Yeah, so this is fascinating because feminism grew up along with both, you know, the French Revolution and socialism. And so it was a very natural fit for feminism and communism to actually fuse together, which it did in around the 1920s. There was a woman who was in charge of the International Communist Bureau, or I can't remember what the name of it was. And she, Congress maybe, anyway, she was believed that if we could get angry women, which she saw the feminists as just a bunch of angry women, if she we could get them, they could get them to their side, then it would be just an incredibly powerful force for the communist revolution that she was working for. And they were all fighting, the communists were all fighting for. But what was fascinating about it was the fact that she recognized that anger was such an important part of feminism. And that's something that goes back to the early 1890s, where the socialists realized that women were much more politically engaging if they were mad. So this is where the idea of consciousness raising started, just getting a group of women together to complain about things and not to try to heal or correct anything, but just to be mad. And that was really used by the communists. And this is actually where the day, the International Women's Day comes from, was this idea of, you know, trying to bring the feminists along to the Communist Party. So it's really interesting to see the way that their goals overlapped, because the feminists really wanted to get rid of family and faith. And of course, we know the communists wanted the same thing. So it just ended up being this natural fit. And you end up seeing a lot of this in the work of specifically Betty Friedan. She was very much involved with communism. There's a whole book written about it by a friend of hers. And unfortunately, her private papers are not going to be available for another 9 years. But even from what's publicly available, the case was very easily made that she was deeply involved with the Communist Party and really promoting this idea of women being productive outside the home, which is why the feminine mystique was such an important work, because she used a lot of psychology to sort of manipulate women into believing that they would be happier outside the home than in.
Yeah, I always say that feminism has really been, for the last several decades, the tip of the spear of the cultural Marxist assault on our civilization. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that?
I would totally agree with that. And I think it's fascinating to go back and look at how effective it's been, because people have their guard down against feminism in the way that they don't when you're just talking about communism. It hasn't been well studied, it hasn't been well articulated, and it hasn't been exposed for the, you know, exactly what it is. It's just another godless egalitarian ideology. And so I think it's had the capacity to do a lot of damage by influencing women in ways that they, you know, women like being influenced by magazines and talk shows and, you know, influencers, and especially on social media. And this is the way in which it's been done. And that's actually one of the reasons why I wrote Theology of Home, was how do we start shifting the message in a way that's packaged that women actually like it and want to be engaged with, instead of suggesting that, you know, women go read more Marx.
Yeah, you mentioned a moment ago about this occult connection to feminism, which I also found really interesting in the book. Yeah. How did a fascination with the occult shape feminist thought? And is it still a dominant element of feminism?
Yes, absolutely. No, this is one of the most fascinating threads of the research that I've done, is that the occult piece goes back to the work of Percy Shelley, of all people. His mother-in-law was Mary Wollstonecraft. His father-in-law was a man named William Godwin, whom most of us should know, but very few of us have heard of, because he was so instrumental in influential on the work of Marx, and believed that marriage was a kind of slavery. So Shelley takes an idea from his father-in-law that marriage is bad, so he's focused on this idea of promiscuity. From his mother-in-law, he takes the idea that male hierarchies are bad, and even this kind of deep contempt for men. So that's included in his vision. And then he adds his own interest in the occult, and Shelley was deeply involved in the occult. So he takes those three pieces and he kind of blends them together into this character named Sithna in one of his poems. And she becomes this model of sorts for women in the 1800s and certainly part of theosophy, which grew out of it. He also rewrites Genesis and tries to make, you know, using Paradise Lost from Milton, he tries to make Satan this hero, and therefore Eve becomes a heroine. She becomes, you know, enlightened through the serpent instead of somehow, you know, falling from grace. And that whole rewriting of Genesis, you can actually see deeply in the women's movement. Elizabeth Cady Stanton writes about it. She's got this book called The Women's Bible, which when you read it feels much more like an adolescent girl's, you know, journal or her diary complaining about men or something. But this was very profoundly deep in the women's movement and part and parcel of it. Elizabeth Cady Stanton got her idea for the Seneca Falls Convention from a spirit table, because spiritualism was very big. You have a woman like Victoria Woodhull, who was also involved in seances. She was actually given a brokerage firm because she was so successful in predicting, you know, what people ought to invest in because of her consulting of the spirits. So it was very much part of the movement. And the last person I'll mention was Matilda Gage, who ended up, who was the mother-in-law of L. Frank Baum, who wrote The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
So I, you know, all of this feels like some deep, obscure history until you look at young women in the culture today. And what is it that young women in the culture today are very much defined by? It is contempt for men, the occult, and promiscuity. And those are the very same things that Percy Shelley articulated, you know, over 200 years ago for what he called the women's revolution.
Yeah, you call feminism a rival faith to Christianity. You call it a shadow church that seeks to subvert and replace Christian culture. Can you describe that a little bit more?
Sure. So, you know, what I just described, I call the three commandments of feminism. They are, you know, the way in which feminists are supposed to act. But I had that idea and several other ideas that I was trying to, you know, grapple with. How do we explain this to women? How do we help women understand just how deeply embedded this has become in our culture and our ethos and just how deeply the ideology is at work in our lives? And it suddenly occurred to me, because I realized, you know, the first piece of feminism that's important is this idea of female autonomy. And I think that's really the idol of feminism, this breaking away from any kind of vulnerability that comes with family life, it comes with having children, and trying to sort of bubble wrap women from any kind of emotional pain that comes from those realities, from our relationships. And this is not to say that there have not been bad men and there are not reasons why we need to protect women. But the problem is the way to protect women that they've opted for is just completely like checking out of those relationships instead of, you know, trying to prove men and improve men and themselves. So this is the idol is female autonomy. And then I realized there were these three commandments. I also realized that instead of faith, hope, and love that you find those theological virtues in Christianity, you've got contempt, rage, and envy are really the emotions that women are supposed to feel generally. You have a sacrament. You even have a kind of evangelization where, you know, broken women break other people. And so it just gets passed on through that brokenness. And then as well, of course, through, you know, the way in which it's been made to look very attractive and compelling in the culture. And its opposite looked, you know, be very denigrated. Anyone who sort of doesn't follow along with the feminist ethos is somehow a doormat. So I realized, you know, these are all components that have just that shadow the Christian church. It's not something new. It's just a way that women know how to live their lives the way that a religion informs our lives. So it was a really great, I think, a great insight because it helped me realize why it's so hard for women to get out of feminism. Because feminism provides the way that we need to think, we need to feel, we need to act. And it you know, it's all right there at our fingertips and very much acting like a religion does.
Yeah, I'm sure you know the old feminist slogan, a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle.
I do.
When you think of that and when you see book titles like Are Men Necessary? Or you hear a slogan like The Future is Female, what false messaging is that inculcating in women and men?
Yeah.
And what's the effect on society?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And it's very, you know, those kinds of titles make it very explicit what this goal of female autonomy is, that women don't need to be in relationship with men. And it really eliminates this idea of the complementarity of male and female and the incredible gift that's available to us when we, you know, order our lives around that beautiful biblical model. So I think that's the message that women get, is that men are useless or like walls don't craft thought. They're an obstacle to our potential. And that's the message that's out there for young women, instead of really this understanding that our lives are meant to be lived in a family unit. This is, you know, this incredible balance of the gifts that men have, that women have. And that this is the real tragedy too, I think, of feminism, is that it has the capacity to silence men like nothing else I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look around, I'm sure you've experienced this in your own life and know many men who experience this. Is this kind of like shutting down of conversation, because I think men intrinsically want to support women. They want to be helpful, and they don't want it to do something that they think is harming women. And this is, you know, one of the ways that feminism has protected itself, by saying, oh, well, if you're not a feminist, you must not want to help women. You know, it's made it it's sort of synonymous with promoting womanhood, when in fact it does just the opposite. So I think that the results, you know, we see them around us all the time, is just some incredibly unhappy men. Remarkably, you know, we see this this rise of a vicious element of the manosphere, which is, you know, holds women in contempt. I'm kind of amazed it took 50 years for it to happen. I think it speaks to the patience that men have had. I also think it speaks to the fact that we've gotten to a point where young men probably have never experienced a good woman or a mother who nurtured them properly. So I'm not surprised by it. I'm surprised it happened as late as it did. But I think the bigger issue is that it's mirroring radical feminism. So instead of women being contemptuous of men, it's just men who are being contemptuous of women. And that's obviously not going to be a great way forward either. There's no healing in that, because you're still trying to skirt around this idea of complementarity.
Yeah, totally agree. The whole concept of feminism and the manosphere, that's a whole other episode.
Yeah, right.
I've written actually quite a bit about that, but so I know something about it.
I'd love to hear what you think. Yeah.
It'd be interesting to have a conversation about that, but I want to get back to something that you've touched on before. You talk about how feminism has been or is a rival faith to Christianity, but it's infiltrated even conservative or religious communities. Such that the feminist war on Christianity and the church is now being waged from within. How has feminism managed to do that?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is partially part of what I was talking about previously, this idea that feminism is just about helping women. It really takes people's guard down, I think, because when it's defined that way, instead of really understanding all of these other ideological pieces that are at work. And I think there's been a lot of women who are very well-intentioned, and they think, you know, if we can just reach the feminists with a Christian message, then we can make them more like Christians than feminists. The problem is, of course, that it hasn't actually worked that way. Certainly there are going to be some examples of it working, but the bigger trend has been the opposite effect, is to see that women, Christian women, are becoming more like feminists instead of more deeply Christian. So that, I think, is the real problem that we're facing. And one of the reasons why I wrote this book, in addition to just, you know, making it clear what's going on with ideology, but we have to help Christian women understand what it means to be a Christian woman, and just the incredible wealth that we have in that gift of being Christian, and, you know, that Christ is the answer to these issues that we have. We don't need this ideology to come along and somehow balance things out, or, you know, add a piece that was not already there. What we really need to do is look at the beauty of Christianity and the way in which there's no other movement or organization that's been better for women in all of human history. So I think that's the message that we need to get back to, instead of, you know, somehow making saints or heroes out of these women that really have actually only just fundamentally distorted the Christian vision instead of adding to it in some kind of compelling way.
You touched on this earlier about feminism and anger. Mm-hmm. When you look at the intense political activism that's going on in America today, you see that a lot of it is driven by women who seem positively possessed by ideological fervor. Is this another example of how feminism has created a rival faith to Christianity?
Absolutely. I think, you know, it's really the fruit of feminism to see all this anger, because this has been the, from the modus operandi from the very beginning. How do you get women angry such that they become good foot soldiers for you? Because nobody wants to fight with an angry woman. There's nothing, you're not going to win because there's something deeply irrational about it. And we can see, I don't think I'm telling people something they don't already know. You can see it in the news cycle daily, that there's something really unhealthy going on there. So I think that's one of the fundamental problems, is it's because it's an ideology, it puts women in this very aggressive position where they don't actually, there's no sense of asking if they're actually right. And this is what ideologies do, is they sort of lock the mind onto this one goal, and everything else sort of is obscured or falls away from reality. And I think that's what we're seeing. But you add on to that this real emotional baggage. And I think probably it's best explained too by this idea of misplaced compassion, that women have this belief that if they just feel something strong enough, they can change the world. They can change things around them. And what they don't realize is that there's a good way to do that and a bad way to do that. And what we're seeing is the bad way, but it's been very effective for them for so long, because most of us just don't want to engage with it. And this is why it's kind of run amok, because there hasn't been boundaries of people who are going to push back on it. And in fact, if anything, it's actually been so successful that women just feel like they should keep using it, because it's this affirmation loop happening. But the reality is that women really need to just understand the way in which we're being manipulated. I think very few of us are aware of that, because it's been so effectively kind of ingrained into the culture and in our lives through manipulation of algorithms and all kinds of reasons. But that's not what we're made for. We're not made to be angry all the time. We're really meant to live with a much deeper sense of peace, order, wisdom, all those beautiful attributes that women have that I think are just hard to find in the culture today, unfortunately.
You touched on this a moment ago also, about dissenting from that rival faith. If you do that, you're treated like an apostate.
Yeah.
It's like if you're black and openly vote conservative, you incur a really vicious wrath from the true believers.
Yeah.
Do you think that a significant percentage of women would be more willing to free themselves from the prison of feminism if the social and cultural consequences weren't so high?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's exactly right. I think one of the things about feminism that's interesting is it has kind of this mean girl factor about it, that if you don't go along with it, you're really gonna, like you said, incur the wrath of other women. And part of that is just kind of built into womanhood, in the sense that if you're not part of the group, you're kind of a threat, or you're vulnerable too. Women, so we see this in the fashion industry, the fact that we're all kind of a slave to the fashion industry, but instead of seeing it as that, we really see it as something, cosmopolitan and savvy. And, the woman who's, dressed very on trend is actually upheld as a good thing instead of a negative thing. And I don't mean to go after the fashion industry. I just think it's just a great symbol of what happens with ideas in the culture as well, and that women are very beholden to ideas and sort of fitting in and mirroring other women. And so when you don't do that, it makes everybody a little bit uncomfortable, and because it forces people to actually ask questions about themselves. Is this really right? Am I doing the right thing? And a lot of times that can be very uncomfortable, especially with women who have actually identified deeply with the ideology, where their ego and the ideology are tightly connected. And that's where I think we get kind of the mean girl, as opposed to just those who are kind of going along mindlessly. I think there's always a high cost to pay when you're challenging people for deeply held beliefs. And I think that one of the things I'm seeing a lot of is just people are responding, in a way that's, they're they can see that change could really happen. They can see that what they've been living is kind of, they've been very incubated, and they haven't had the capacity to sort of think outside of those boundaries that have been set by the culture. And when they start seeing something different, I think it's been very freeing. And you know, this is what I'm hearing from a lot of women, and certainly a lot of men, who I think are grateful that you know, the alarm is being sounded, that this has not been a healthy thing for society at all.
Yeah, Carrie, I saw a short video the other day posted on X by a young woman who said that when she was in college, her Christian boyfriend suggested that when they finish college, they get married, and he would offer her a life in which she could be a stay-at-home mom, and he would take care of her and support her and the child and the family. And she said in the video that at the time she was appalled by this because she'd been indoctrinated, although she didn't use that word, to prioritize career. So she broke up with that boyfriend, finished her degree in the chosen field, and pursued that career. And in the video, she suddenly breaks down and tearfully expresses that she had changed her mind, that she didn't want that anymore. And it was a really heartbreaking confession to watch, her realization that she had made this deeply regrettable choice. And I suspect that she spoke for many, many others like herself who were afraid to speak that taboo truth. Do you think that women raised on feminism are starting to wise up to the damage and the negative outcomes that it's led to for women?
Yeah, I do, actually. I think the culture, you know, women are beginning to realize it, and exactly what you said. They're starting to speak up about it. There was a country music song that I can't remember the name of that was exactly that storyline, too, of that, just a deep regret about rejecting the man who wanted to have a family and whatnot. So I think that, and this is, but you know, anybody who's been paying attention to feminists have been hearing for a long time, the women who get to 50, 60, 70, this is, you know, they're living a life that they never expected. They didn't expect to be alone.
Yeah.
And that's the real tragedy behind it, is that women, you know, when you're young and you're in your 20s, you're sort of put on this trajectory and you have no idea where it's taking you, but you're trying to check all the boxes that people tell you that you're supposed to check. And not really realizing that those are, you know, this isn't really the real thing that your life is meant for. Women weren't made to live a career. They were made for a vocation. They were made for a specific calling, and whatever form that might take, that God obviously has plans for each of us. But when you tell women that the ultimate goal is to have this certain kind of career and you should freeze your eggs and put off all your relationships until later, it's just an incredible disservice we're doing to women, because of the fact that it's breaking all of those, you know, the things that are most important to women, which is deep and thick relationships. And those are very hard to nurture when, you know, all your focus is on your career and you know, reaching for that next promotion or that next raise, instead of really being focused on, you know, what is it that God has planned for my life, particularly in the form of family and being in connection and relationship with other people.
Feminism is so deeply entrenched in Western culture, and you've suggested that we can be hopeful, that we can free ourselves from that mindset. What are some steps, some practical steps that people could take to resist or to counteract feminist influences?
Yeah, I think the first thing is to really just even be aware of the way in which it influences us. I think, you know, every Western woman, no matter where we're at in our journey, is recovering from feminism in one form or another. I know I'm still recovering from it, despite the fact that I've been keenly aware of the way it's been manipulating me for well over a decade. But I think it's just deeply entrenched in us. So it's that's the first thing, is understanding the way it's formed the way that we think about things. The second thing I think we can do is certainly stop using the word, you know, trying to make it good. It's not good. It's not pro-woman. It's a Marxist ideology that's trying to destroy faith and family. And, you know, the sooner that we can get that message across to people and stop trying to make it into something good, I think that's helpful. The third thing I would suggest too for women is getting back to this idea of loving at the local level. This is something that, you know, women, our whole body is made to hold, to house, to give life. And that's a reflection on who it is that we're meant to be. And this is where we can really start changing. If we want to change the culture, which most women, or the world really, most women have this desire, it has to start on this local level. And it's in those experiences of loving the people around us that, you know, if we're meant to do something bigger, God's going to inculcate those virtues in a small way. And then, you know, we'll be trusted to something bigger down the road. But if we can't figure out that on a small level in the first place, then we will never get to the bigger. And this is, again, where you see that the extremism is this idea of, you know, people showing up in a different state with people they don't know, with, you know, attacking something they don't really understand the whole reality of. It's that, you know, disordered compassion that women have, that, the you know, the woman that works for PETA, but she's aborted her own child. It's that reordering of that. So I think that that's the simplest way to think about it, is getting back to the local and loving those around us. And women have this incredible capacity also to bring people together. You know, all of these amazing ways in which women used to bring communities together. I think this is one of the reasons why people are so lonely, is that there aren't women there to organize the event after the funeral, or to bring, you know, meal to some people who are suffering, or just even be aware of those who are alone. You know, we don't have time because we spent so much of our time believing that we have to, you know, have a full-time job and be a full-time mom. And there's just no extra room in there for living and loving on that local level. So I think those are the first ways in which we need to start. And then from there, you kind of branch off into what the specific call is. And that's, I think, where it gets really exciting. When you bring order, then God can be much more creative in our specific lives.
Yes, good advice. Carrie, I know you've just released this book, but are you working on something new now? And also, how can people best keep up with what you're doing?
Something Wicked just came out. So I am just busy promoting that right now. I'm taking a hiatus from writing anything at the moment. The next book, I think, is, I've already kind of gotten mine, but I'm not at all ready to commit to it because, there's so much that I'm doing with this. But I guess that's the other great thing. That's a process about writing a book, is that when you talk to people about it afterwards, you really start realizing what it is that people want to talk about, what they want to hear about, where the hole is in the conversation. And so that, I think, is, you know, I'm kind of doing some of the early research for whatever the next book will end up being. And the best place to find me is either at Instagram. I'm Carrie Gress at Instagram, or Facebook, or my website, carriegress.com, or my Substack at Theology of Home.
Good to know. Well, I really loved this book, and I can't emphasize enough to listeners how critical it is for our culture to embrace your message and begin the process of undoing the catastrophe of feminism and healing the rift between the sexes. Carrie Gress, thanks so much for coming to The Right Take, and keep up the great work.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Really an honor.
Listeners, make sure you get a copy of Carrie Gress's new book, Something Wicked, and thank me later. And thank you for tuning in. As always, don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you.